United States Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice of presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Good morning. We have our second case for oral argument that will be about to be presented. But first, I want to address court with class. We have Sun Prairie East High School here. If you could please stand. Good group. Nice to see you. After oral arguments this morning, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will be available to speak with you if you're able to stay. Nice to see you. And also, Monticello High School, if you could rise. All right. Nice to see you all, too. Good groups. You'll have a large audience to speak with today. Again, same invitation to you. If you could stay after and you want to speak with Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, she will be available to you. Go ahead and have a seat. The case that we're calling this morning is State versus Stetzer. Could I have your appearances?
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Attorney Anthony Patton and Attorney Paul Ramsey for Dr. Stetzer. She's here as well.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. The state appears by Assistant Attorney General John.
All right. Good morning. The lineup is 25 minutes, followed by 30 minutes, 5 minutes on rebuttal. If that's your understanding, let's proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice and Your Honors. What an honor it is to be here today in front of all of you. We thank you so much for accepting this important case. And it is an important case because in May of 2017, Dr. Stetzer faced an unfathomable choice. That night started out like any other night for her. She was cooking dinner for the family. She had a few glasses of wine at dinner, and as she was cooking dinner, everything was normal. The children were there in the house. They have one of their children has special needs. Dr. Stetzer made dinner for the family. The children eventually went upstairs to bed, and it was once the children retired to their bedrooms that Joan's husband, Bill, began becoming very aggressive towards her. Joan had confronted him again about his long history of marital infidelity. He had engaged in a series of affairs over the years that spanned back many, many years. And an argument erupted over that, or an argument developed about that. And Bill started doing what Bill typically does, which is to blame the affairs on her, to tell Joan that she's nuts, that she's crazy, that she's using horrible language. I won't repeat here, but it's in the briefs. And belittling her and demeaning her. The argument ended without a major physical confrontation, which is frankly surprising at that point because there is a very long history of physical domestic abuse that Joan has been subjected to at the hands of her husband. And that's also in the briefs, Your Honors, but a long history of Bill becoming physically violent with her when they would attempt to have discussions about his marital infidelity, situations where he has physically shoulder-checked her into the fireplace on one occasion. Another time where Bill felt that she wasn't listening carefully enough to him as he was trying to justify his affairs, and he grabbed her by the face and twisted her neck 90 degrees to force her to make eye contact with him. And over the years, Joan has withstood that abuse and remained in her marriage largely because of her special needs child that she feels requires a lot of assistance, but also because of her Catholic vows. That night, Bill left the house at about 8 o'clock, maybe a little bit later. Bill leaves the house. The Stetzer family has two homes. I think everybody understands that from the briefing. The two homes are about 12 minutes or so apart. One is in Pewaukee and one is in Merton, in sort of a rural area of Waukesha County. After the argument developed between Joan and her husband, Bill storms out of the house, calling her names as he always does. Joan, frankly, had had enough by that point. And what she did was she took his clothes and she put them outside. This ignited a fuse, the likes of which Joan has never seen before, and which Bill testified to ultimately at trial, that he was in a complete maniacal rage. What happened is Joan went to bed. She's in her pajamas. She's in her bedroom. The children are sleeping. and she awakens to the door slamming shut as she sees her husband tearing into the bedroom, screaming at her, "Pick my clothes up from outside. You get those clothes and you get them inside right now." And she's wiping the sleep out of her eyes and trying to process what's happening, and he's in a rage, screaming at her. She's never seen this look in her husband's eyes before. Even though he's been physically violent, she's never seen this type of rage. Dr. Stetzer gets up. He's following her around the house on that first floor. It's a two-story home, but he's on the first floor, and he's following her everywhere she goes. He's screaming at her, calling her the horrible names he always calls her, belittling her. She's a world-class anesthesiologist, a respected doctor in our community, and he's calling her a piece of trash. Follows her around. She gets to the staircase by the basement, and he shoulder checks her down the stairs. She tumbles down 10 stairs into the basement, injuring her neck and her shoulder, which she had to undergo weeks of physical therapy to heal from. After recovering from that injury, Dr. Stetzer, who had had some alcohol earlier with dinner, thought to herself, "I can't go to the emergency room. I'm going to know every doctor. She is the anesthesiologist in Waukesha County. Everybody in the emergency room relies on her for services." And she makes the decision to self-medicate. She takes two large gulps, swigs, if you will, of wine. She's sitting there at the table, decides, "I have to leave." She walks out of the house. She goes into the garage. Her husband at this time taunts her, "I'm going to call the police again like I've done before. I'm going to call 911 on you. You're the reason that this is all happening." And Joan gets to the garage in her pajamas, and she thinks to herself, "This is crazy. I can't, what are we doing?" And she walks back into the home. Bill has already called 911 to report that she is the abuser. And when she walks back into the home, Bill rips a cast iron pot off the hanging pot rack, and he's screaming at her, "I'm going to take you out," and he chases her into the garage. She's running as fast as she can, and Joan gets into the garage, and he takes the pot and he flings it at her head, narrowly missing her as she escapes to the safety of her vehicle, which fortunately was parked in the driveway facing out. She gets in her car, and she has Bill pounding on the table, or pounding on the hood of the car, pounding on the windows, chasing her around the vehicle, screaming at her that he is going to kill her. And Joan was confronted with an unfathomable choice that night, a choice that I hope nobody ever has to be confronted with in their life. Does she flee to the safe place that she knows is a safe place, the 12-minute drive to the lake home, or does she allow herself to be potentially killed by her abuser? Now, I want to thank Mr. Flynn and the state for their concession in this case that they've made in the briefs that her decision to drive was privileged at its inception. I want to thank the state for that concession, because with her history of abuse and victimization, anybody would make the decision that she made to flee her attacker. And she did flee her attacker. But her nightmare didn't end there. Her nightmare continued, because what did Bill do? He called 911 and reported that she is the abuser. She's the one who's attacking me. She's the one who's getting in my face and being aggressive. He turned the tables on her again, like he's done on two prior occasions. And what happens to Joan? As she's driving down the road, a rural area at 2 in the morning where it's dark out, and it's a very rural area, Joan passes a police car that she sees on the side of the road. And the state makes great effort and spills a lot of ink talking about the fact that Joan passed a squad car on the side of the road. She did, after a few minutes of driving, as she's only a few minutes from her safe place. And she continues driving. She thinks to herself, "This is not safe for me to stop right now." She's still in the fear, and the record is clear that even when Officer Keel pulled her over, Officer Keel said in her report that Dr. Stetzer, in the moment she was pulled over, still was under the fear of her husband's attack. Joan is in her pajamas. She has no cell phone with her. Her son's cell phone with her, which is passcode locked. She doesn't have her cell phone because Bill in the house had actually positioned himself to prevent her from getting her phone.
Counsel, in your recitation of these facts, midway in the recitation, you state, as she escapes to the safety of her vehicle, you followed that statement, which I just read verbatim, with then the husband coming and pounding on the vehicle. She takes off. Then she's still in the safety of her vehicle, isn't she?
She's in the vehicle where he is not. That is true. Factually, I agree with you.
So to take your words, she escaped to the safety of her vehicle. Not immediately, because he was there, but 2 blocks down, 4 blocks down, 1 mile down the road. Isn't she in the safety of her vehicle?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think this is a very good case to also look at the amicus briefing that was done in here. The experiences of battered women specifically. And I want to touch on that because I think that's a very good question. And it really...
Well, I'm taking your statement. Now, maybe you engaged in a little hyperbole and didn't really mean the safety of escaping, as she escapes to the safety of her vehicle. Maybe that was not artfully stated. Yes or no? I'm giving you a little room here, counsel.
I'll accept. retract that for the record. What I did mean by that is that at that moment, Bill is not in the car. And so even though he's launched a cast iron pan at her head, she is still under the imminent fear of death or great bodily harm at that moment, and that's what's so important about this case, because it's not a safe spot for her in that moment. He's pounding on the hood, he's pounding on the windows, and he has just told her he's going to try to kill her. And so the reason why this is important is because in her mind, in that moment, she feared death or great bodily harm, and that's why the state at the trial court and here in briefing has conceded that decision to drive under the influence with a prohibited alcohol concentration was privileged.
Attorney Cotton, how far can she go? I think the circuit court gave an example and said, could someone drive from Wisconsin to Tennessee just because they were coerced the moment they decided to drive? What's your response? What's the limiting principle here?
The limiting principle is the plain language of the statute, Your Honor. So what the coercion statute says, 93946, is it says that a person who reasonably believes that their life is in death or that they face death or great bodily harm is and believes that their act is the only means of preventing that imminent death or great bodily harm, that they have a complete defense to that act. That's what the statute says. And what the legislature did when it gave us this language was to provide, clear language to lower courts and to defendants in general that her act is what's privileged. And so my answer to your question would be driving from point A to point B under these circumstances was the privileged act, that she was driving under the influence to the safe place 12 minutes away.
And your point, though, in saying that, though, is that that couldn't change? Because what work does the word only do? Like, she may have, and I believe, I mean, having presided over domestic violence court for 3.5 years, having prosecuted these cases.
Yes.
I mean, this is a very different situation than a person that has not been abused and what they believe, viewed from their perspective,
yes,
is they will be imminently harmed. However, having said all that, are you saying that nothing can change along the way? And I think that is the state's argument, is that the word only is there, and that even if the intent was to drive from point A to point B, which I hear you saying could be to Tennessee, at some point does that imminent, the only means of preventing imminent bodily harm change, or can it?
So, yes, things, circumstances absolutely can change along the way. If Dr. Stetzer stopped and met a friend for coffee and then continued driving, certainly under those circumstances there's been an interruption of the act, and I think at that point her behavior wouldn't be protected under the coercion statute. But I think, Justice Dallet, I'm glad you brought up your experiences as a trial court judge. I know a number of you have that experience as well. What's important about those experiences is that the trial court judges in our state do play a very important gatekeeping function. And so, and that will continue to occur. Trial court judges can say that this person drove to Tennessee, that does not fit. The jury shouldn't be instructed on the coercion defense. It doesn't come in automatically.
Yes, but aren't we the ones that get to say where that limit is? And I think that's what Justice Protasiewicz was asking. What's the limiting principle? What if she got in a car accident and killed someone along the way? She was driving under the influence. That's the reality, unfortunately, of her predicament. Where and that under your theory that she would have had a full defense to that, and maybe that's right for a certain period of time, but is there some limiting principle, or is it just whatever that person believes?
Well, the state cited the Coleman case, for example, where there was the felon in possession, where a defendant can possess a firearm for the limited purpose of repelling an attack. This court has certainly created limiting principles in other situations and can choose to do so. I think what ought to guide this court's analysis is the plain language of the statute, though. What happened in this case is that Dr. Stetzer was driving from point A to point B. She was committing a specified act. And the coercion statute does provide a complete defense to that act. The language is in the jury instruction, which has been adopted as an accurate statement of the law, that her decision to drive under the influence, that act, that one continuous act, is protected if she believed that her life was in danger. And that's the reason why the defense, in our opinion, is entitled to a judgment of acquittal in this case, because the state introduced no competing evidence to rebut that.
Counsel, yeah. The state's argument, as I understand it, and you're right, they've made the concession about the reasonableness of your client's decision to drive under the influence to escape threat. The issue, I think, narrowing it down a bit, is when she came upon the police, understanding that she may have been dealt with quite unfairly by the police in the past based on her husband's manipulations of law enforcement, even accepting that, at that point in time, did her belief that she was under a threat of imminent bodily harm or death go away because the police, while they may have dealt with her unfairly in the past, did not pose a threat of great bodily harm or imminent death? I understand your argument to be that, well, it continues until, and I think the point of some of my colleagues' questions and my question as well is, are you asking us to limit a holding to these particular facts? The problem with doing that, counsel, is because then this creates a precedent for other cases, and there has to be a stopping point. I don't think you're arguing that it would have been reasonable to drive clear across the country. Your argument is it was okay to bypass the police and go to her other home. But do you see the problems I think we're all grappling with here? With
yes.
Legally, with the legal principle.
Yes. So I think where Judge Bugenhagen at the trial court level, I think where he was fixated, because he says it four times in the record, is on this phrase, only means necessary. And Judge talked about that four separate times in his reasoning. He said that. But there's a separate part of the jury instruction that talks about the reasonable belief of the defendant. And that's why this is so important in this case. I do think to some extent the facts of this case are unique facts, as many Supreme Court cases end up being. Your Honors only accept a small fraction of cases for that reason. So there are unique facts here. I don't think that there's anything confusing or ambiguous about the statute. The statute, the plain language of the law, permitted Dr. Stetzer to commit that act. And her act was driving under the influence. I also think the important thing is that Judge Bugenhagen didn't look at this case, and he was required to, as what would a reasonable person do under the circumstances of a domestic violence victim, being a battered spouse, what would be reasonable
okay,
for that?
Okay, and Attorney Cotton, that's an issue that I thought was perhaps not fully developed in the briefs. Certainly fully developed. You had an expert, you know, at the trial court. I understand that. But the argument that I'm having a issue following, and hopefully you can clarify, is it a reasonable person who had been the victim of domestic abuse that particular evening, or a reasonable person who's been subjected to continuous domestic abuse throughout their marriage?
Thank you for that question. And the way I think that the court ought to look at this is the same way that the instruction committee looked at it in Instruction 790, which is objectively we do look at whether a defendant's a person of ordinary intelligence and prudence, but the instruction tells the trial court judges to look at it in the defendant's position as it existed at that time. And so factually in this case, we had Dr. Hanusa who testified He's a world-renowned expert on domestic violence. He's a now retired professor here at UW-Madison, and he testified that Dr. Stetzer was the highest lethal category that exists of a potential being a potential homicide victim. And so we do look at it from the perspective of the abuse victim in those circumstances, because that's why she had to drive under the influence.
Counsel, can I ask you on that particular point? We have a woman who's been traumatized at home, who had been having a few drinks at home because she wasn't anticipating having to get behind the wheel, and I understand also took some kind of sleeping pill. Is that all accurate?
The sleeping pill wasn't developed in the record. That was another claim that the husband had made against his wife.
Okay, thank you for clarifying.
That's Bill's claim that he made to the police.
Okay, so we're dealing with somebody who's at home having a few drinks because she was anticipating staying home.
Right.
Okay, so do we take account of the fact that, and this all happened in the middle of the night, so are we to look at her position, her subjective beliefs, or are we to look at anybody in that position who's kind of under the influence and awakened from maybe a deep sleep? Are we supposed to look at that and how that might affect her thinking because she's not quite awake and she's under the influence? So are you asking us to look at that and say, because of those factors bypassing the police, while somebody who, you know, if this is happening at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, instead with somebody who isn't under the influence, that person might have made a different choice, but we have to look at what an average person, a reasonable person would do given those factors.
Every person in this situation, like Joan faced, would be under the influence because by the nature of what happened here, it was a prohibited alcohol concentration. I think she was a 0.11 or 1.2, a relatively low blood alcohol level. So everybody would be in that situation. Certainly the trial court will, I think this court ought to give the language of the statute its ordinary and plain meaning. The legislature did not say that you subdivide the act into small, minuscule individual acts. And so I guess what I would say to you, Your Honor, is that we do look at it as the objectively reasonable person, but in the circumstances that they existed for the person. Yes, she had had some alcohol that night. She had had some wine. Yes, that the trial court judge can take that into account however he or she sees fit. And that's why trial court judges will remain the gatekeeper, Your Honor, in all of these circumstances.
Can I just follow up real quick?
Sure, please.
Legal Action has filed an amicus brief in this case.
Yes.
That takes your argument to what may be a logical extension if we were to accept it, urging this court to adopt a rule that would take account of race, ethnicity, gender identity, sexual orientation, and then make different rules for different people based on identities. And I'm just confessing to you, I'm very uncomfortable with that because we all swear an oath to administer justice without respect to person.
Right.
So how do we draw a line in this case if we're accepting your argument? It can't be, counsel, can it, that somebody who doesn't fit one of these categories is held to a higher standard, right?
Right. I agree with you fully on that, and you'll notice that Attorney Riley, who helped with the briefing, and I didn't tread into that territory in our briefs because that's not the focal point of our argument. We are not seeking a different rule that applies towards somebody of a specific gender or somebody of a specific race. We think the rules ought to apply equally to all people. But the jury instruction does tell the court and the jury to look at it from the circumstance of the defendant at that time.
Counsel, what you are arguing for is that not an objective standard, reasonable person, but a subjective standard for reasonable person. Now, I don't want to say that takes my breath away because I save my breath being taken away for different kinds of issues. But it causes me to pause, that's for sure, that we would embrace a subjective, reasonable person standard rather than the objective. And you cite to jury instruction for that premise. Cite the case that you're relying on or the cases that you're relying on that say, no, we don't do the objective reasonable person standard. We employ a subjective reasonable person standard. With those words.
As Your Honor obviously knows from having studied the briefing closely, there isn't a wide array of case law. There's no case law that says what you just said.
And
there's not a lot of... And this certainly will be one that Your Honors have to wrestle with, what is the important principles that you decide matter here. I would go back to the plain language of the statute, because that's what the legislature gave us. The legislature passed 939-46. It's been on the books for over 40 years or 50 years. And that statute says that her act, driving under the influence, her act, is a defense to a prosecution for that crime. And I want to emphasize, the legislature has imposed a limiting principle, Your Honor. In that statute, first-degree homicide is exempted. It's ameliorated down to a second degree. So the legislature knows how to act. If they want to limit this further and say, we find drunk driving to be so bad, we want to eliminate that defense, they can do so. I'm not asking you, Your Honor, to impose a unique subjective standard for one defendant in one case. What I'm asking you to do is embrace the language that the legislature has given us, which is to say that a defendant in these circumstances has a complete defense to that act, the act in this case being driving from point A to point B.
I want to ask about that, because there is much made of the fact that driving is an ongoing act.
Or continuous,
as I said. Or a continuous act. So what is the act? Is the act what the person identifies the place that they were going, and then it doesn't matter if they saw the police in the meantime? I mean, that's what you're saying?
Yeah, the act in this case was driving from point A to point B. That's what the act was. It wasn't driving to Tennessee like the trial court judge.
And it's
judge.
Just not getting in the car and driving, period. It's having the... So then it does
act
seem like... So it's a reasonable person who I... Because she's the one identifying that she's driving from point A to point B. So, I mean...
Right. And when what trial court judges do, Justice Dallet, is they will say this instruction isn't appropriate under these circumstances because we think that this defendant here doesn't fit the criteria. And but that's so different, and that's what differentiates the Kieran case and all the other ones from what happened here, is the state agreed that this defense was applicable. Everybody agreed, and the state continued to agree, even in its briefing, that she was entitled to the coercion defense. And that's different than a lot of the cases. I see my time is up.
You may finish your sentence.
Chief, I just have a quick follow-up, too, please, when he's done.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's fine. I'll just take the follow-up question if that's appropriate.
I was curious to hear how you ended that.
So what I think is important at the end of the day is simply the language of the statute. That's the point I was trying to make, that I think the legislature has given us clear language, and you asked about the act. What is it? The act is always going to be defined to some extent by the person. Now, the court, as a gatekeeper, can decide that this defense isn't applicable, but we don't have that here. Everybody has agreed that coercion applied at its inception.
Nothing could break that chain then? I know you said having lunch, but no other circumstance, outside circumstance, would break that? What if she saw her friend along the way and felt comfortable going to her friend? That doesn't count? It's getting to the actual place?
I think we can hypothesize a million examples of things that like meeting a friend, for example, that...
Well, I'm saying, like, seeing a friend. The idea of the police officer is that she may not escape imminent death or great bodily harm because of how she's been treated, but what if it was, like, she's driving along and sees someone who's offering to help her, or her friend saw what happened at the house? I mean, the reason we have these hypotheticals is because we're trying to test how far this goes.
What I think would happen under any of those circumstances is that the state would argue coercion is not applicable at all in this case, and the trial court judge wouldn't permit that to go to the jury, because that's what judges have historically done with this instruction, is they, just like self-defense and any other instruction, they determine, is it appropriate in the facts of this case? Could a reasonable jury conclude that she was operating under this defense? And if the facts were, she says, I'm driving to Tennessee and I want to meet a girlfriend along the way, any trial court judge would say this doesn't even go to the jury. But here, the trial court judge and the state have conceded that this defense was applicable at its inception, Your Honor. And Chief Judge, may I take Justice Karofsky's question?
Sure. Thank you. I am focusing on the language in 939-46-1 that says
the actor causes the actor reasonably to believe that his or her act is the only means of preventing imminent death or great bodily harm. So I'm focusing on imminent death or great bodily harm, okay? And I just want to make sure I fully understand your argument as to when she is driving and she sees the police car. Why does she continue to fear death or great bodily harm? I don't know if it's death or great bodily harm that you are focusing on. I want to make sure I completely understand your argument.
Thank you. She fears both because she's afraid that the police will return her to her abuser like they've done in the past. And in fact, Your Honor, Justice Karofsky, one of the things that's important about this case is that Joan herself was prosecuted for domestic violence.
She was prosecuted for disorderly conduct as an act of domestic violence.
Yes. And that underscores exactly what she knew in her head would happen when she was operating under that fear at that moment. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
So, Attorney Flynn, what was she supposed to do? When we look at 939-61, and it's the only means, it's a 10 or 12-minute drive. It's 2 in the morning. I don't know that there's anything open along the way where she could stop. She doesn't have a phone that she could use. What's she supposed to do?
Justice Prosewitz, when she saw that police officer, she needed to stop driving. I think the circuit court's record is clear that if that had been the case, it would have acquitted her. When Dr. Stetzer knowingly passed by the police officer, debated whether to stop and didn't, that's why the coercion privilege does not protect her after that point.
But it's pretty clear her husband called the police. She'd be walking into a trap, right?
It is unfortunate to see the criminal justice system weaponized against a victim of domestic abuse. However, he stated things that are true, that she was drunk and she was driving. She was out on the roads posing a danger to the public.
And isn't that why we have the coercion defense? Because we allow the involvement of criminal activity by someone if they are escaping a greater danger?
Yes, but it's a narrow privilege. Case law says only the most dire form of inducement. And once Dr. Stetzer knew she had an alternative other than continuing to drive drunk, only the lesser evil remained of driving drunk.
I think that's the problem, is she didn't know.
She
believed that the police were going to send her right back to her abuser.
The decision of whether that would be objectively reasonable is one we ultimately entrust to our fact finders. Here it was the circuit court. But that is fundamentally what we ask juries to do, to determine whether that sort of belief is reasonable. When presented with new information that makes a defendant's belief not reasonable, they have to stop committing the crime. The language of the statute contains important limiting factors. First, the beliefs must be reasonable. They must be the only means of preventing imminent death or great bodily harm. And this court has already said in Amundsen that we use an objective reasonable person test when deciding whether a defendant's beliefs are reasonable.
You agree that it was reasonable for her to get in the car and leave the driveway, right?
Yes.
And do you agree that it was reasonable for her, therefore, to leave the driveway and drive into the street?
Yes. An important factor here is Dr. Stetzer's testimony that she believed that her husband was following her.
Was it reasonable for her to get in the car, drive out the driveway, drive into the street, and then drive down the block?
Your Honor, this area defies bright-line rules. This is, again, fundamentally what we ask juries to do, is did she have another means of preventing the death or great bodily harm other than continuing to drive.
I think your whole argument here is that you need a bright line rule here. I mean, whether or not anyone in this room likes it, that's what we got to do. So when she got into the road, she pulls out of the driveway and she's in the road and she drives down one block. Is that reasonable?
Again, Your Honor, because of her testimony that she thought her husband was following her, I think that she was privileged to continue driving as long as she believed that he was following her.
Was she privileged to continue driving for 1 mile from her house?
Because she believed that her husband was following her, I agree that she was entitled to the privilege until she saw the police car. Perhaps if she had made it all the way to her house and had never seen the police car, I think she'd be entitled to the privilege the entire time if the fact finder agrees that she reasonably believed she was being followed.
So it's your argument that but for the police car, the coercion defense, she should have had the privilege of the coercion defense if there was no police car the whole distance from her house to the lake house.
I believe a reasonable fact finder could find that, yes.
She had been arrested twice before, right, by the police after her husband called and said she was the one who was being abusive?
Correct.
And in this instance, her fear is that if she stops, and you would agree, I think, wouldn't you, that her husband did present, obviously, he created a reasonable fear of death or great bodily harm in her. You don't disagree with that?
I do not.
Okay. And we just heard your friend on the other side say that the reason she did not want to stop and contact the police was because she was afraid that she would go back to the source of her fear for death and great bodily harm, that the police would send her back, right?
I can't recall her exact testimony on that point. I will take it as true, though. The problem is that for coercion to apply, committing the crime has to be your only means, not your preferred. And I wouldn't say that being taken back to the house, I'm not sure that qualifies as imminent death or great bodily harm.
You just said, like, 2 seconds ago that she had a privilege to leave the house because her husband and drive all the way to her cabin, maybe, because her husband was following her, because she had that reasonable fear of death or great bodily harm. But now because the police are taking her back to the house, somehow that reasonable belief is poof, gone? That doesn't make any sense.
Your Honor, I think that the defendant needs to put on some testimony in order to be entitled to the defense, and they need to put on enough evidence that they reasonably believed both that they were in imminent danger of death or great bodily harm and that committing the crime was the only means.
Well, I happen to know Dr. Hanusa, who testified in this case. Having been a domestic violence prosecutor for several years, I both trained with him and had him in court many times, both where I called him as an expert and when he testified in a court when I was a judge presiding over cases. I read the transcript in this case. I read his testimony in this case. I really do not know how you could possibly lay a better foundation for this than what Dr. Hanusa testified to here. What more would you have need to see?
Your Honor, I don't know that I can provide an answer because that's what we ask juries to do, is to make.
I want to follow up on that, counsel. To what extent, the trial court here found that at the point that Mrs. Setzer passed the squad car, that beyond a reasonable doubt, she knew at that point that of safety other than going to the lake house. And I'm just sort of curious, analytically, is this a question where we take that as a, you know, factual finding that is itself, you know, a reasonable conclusion because the trial court was there hearing the testimony, making kind of credibility determinations? Or is this something where we are supposed to do some independent thinking about whether it was reasonable for her when she saw the squad car to continue driving or not? So just analytically, is this a case where this is a legal judgment where the fact finder has rendered a conclusion where there's sufficient evidence for it in one sense? Or is this something where we're independently making a determination based upon the trial court's findings? How would you, how should we think about that when analyzing this case?
It is a finding of fact. The circuit court is pretty clear that it is making a finding of fact about what she knew and believed. Like all findings of fact, it should be given deference. I'll also note the unusual situation that we have all of these detailed findings of facts and conclusions of law because it was a bench trial. Normally, we'd get a verdict form saying guilty or not guilty.
Right. So in this situation, then, when we're looking at this, if that's correct, assuming you're correct on that, would we have to conclude that it would be unreasonable, you know, in some sense to, you know, no reasonable fact finder could have concluded that she, not to use the word reasonably too many times, but was, it was reasonable for her to believe that this was the only thing she could do to prevent death or great bodily harm.
Like all criminal cases, a sufficiency challenge could be raised, but then we're under the deferential Pollinger standard where essentially, yes, this court would have to determine that no reasonable fact finder could come to that.
So this is really a sufficiency of the evidence case, as you would understand it.
I don't think so, because that's not what the legal issue that was certified was. Issue two raised a legal question of whether the court applied the correct standard of law. So I don't view this as a sufficiency case, but to the extent it is, a reasonable fact finder could come to this conclusion. I'd like to point out one issue with changing how we view the objectively reasonable person test. In this case, Dr. Stetzer did put on Dr. Hanusa and put on very detailed evidence about the effects on a person of being a domestic violence victim. But this court shouldn't alter how we view reasonability, because then that throws into some question, what kind of evidence has to be put on? Who has to put it on? Does the state have to disprove that beyond a reasonable doubt? And there's a reason why we use the objectively reasonable person standard, because it is fair.
Counsel, are you familiar with the Dingwall opinion out of the Seventh Circuit?
I am not.
Well, it seems to suggest that the circuits are split on approaches to expert evidence on battering and its effects. And it indicates the following: thoughtful opinions from our colleagues and other circuits provide useful guidance on the duress defense, where the person posing the threat is not always physically present. And then the opinion cites several of the circuits that indicate a reasonable person in her situation, which seems to me to be a bit subjective.
Well, to clarify, there is a subjective component in that the defendant actually needed to hold these beliefs. And that's why, in the state's view, all of this evidence from Dr. Hanusa is relevant, because it goes to whether she actually did hold these beliefs. And the state's not discounting that she did, certainly when she drove away, but it's that her beliefs became unreasonable when she passed the police car because she knew she had an alternative.
Help me with this, then. I thought that your opposing counsel was arguing for what I termed a subjective reasonable person standard. That is not the reasonable objective person, but a reasonable person in the situation of one who has suffered domestic abuse. And I said, oh, that causes me to pause. You know, that's a change in the law. Cite me a case, not just a jury instruction. But it seems to me that maybe there are cases in the Dingwell discussion of a split in the circuits as to whether or not the reasonable person standard is in her situation. That is, in the situation of someone who suffered from domestic abuse. Any comments? I understand you're not familiar with the case, so you may not be able to respond to my question.
I believe the law in this state, as is accurately summarized in jury instruction 790, is that you consider a reasonable person placed into the defendant's circumstances. So there is some room there, but it's not a person who's identical to the defendant. It's, you know, a random ordinary person thrown into the same situation.
Which is exactly what the language was in Dingwall. A reasonable person in her situation would likely have feared death or serious bodily harm. This was a situation where the defendant participated in a crime scene while accompanied by her heavily armed boyfriend. And they said, even when the boyfriend was not present.
And I don't disagree that you feel, a person could reasonably feel being afraid of imminent death or great bodily harm when the person they are afraid of isn't physically present.
No, I think it's the phrase, in her situation. This is the language. A reasonable person in her situation would likely have feared death or serious bodily harm. I think Justice Anwar Bradley is calling it the subjective. I think it's perhaps more of a hybrid. But there's another case, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Nwoye, N-W-O-Y-E, 2. It's a D.C. Circuit case written by then-Judge Kavanaugh, where he said that the duress defense requires a defendant to have acted reasonably under the circumstances. Expert testimony, which, of course, we had here, can help a jury assess whether a battered woman's actions were reasonable. Expert testimony can be relevant to the duress defense. In words that fit this case, the court wrote, quote, although a jury might not find the appearance sufficient to provoke a reasonable person's fear, they might conclude otherwise as to a reasonable person's perception of the reality when enlightened by expert testimony on the concept of hypervigilance. That was a case where a woman engaged in extortion when her abusive partner was sometimes across the country.
And Attorney Flynn, I'll add on, and then you can respond to both of us if you would. But our research shows that there is an active federal circuit split. And the Ninth Circuit said, quote, a jury may consider the defendant's prior experience with police response to abuse in determining whether it was reasonable for her not to contact them once threatened by the coercing party. If you couple that with Justice Karofsky's question, can you tell us why you think that should or should not be adopted in the state of Wisconsin?
it should not be adopted, and because this court has already determined for the coercion defense specifically what an objective reasonable person test is here. My friend on the other side here didn't ask for that case to be overruled or modified.
Which case are you talking about?
Amundson. So,
I did mention to Attorney Cotton, I think some of that was not developed. Maybe he'll comment on that during rebuttal. But anything you wish to add in that regard?
I'll confess that it was a challenge because there was almost no cases cited. And I wasn't sure what we're talking about, the legal issue or a sufficiency claim.
Yes.
Do you agree with the way the Court of Appeals opinion? Is there anything in the way the Court of Appeals looked at the case that you disagree with or that you think needs attention?
I think Judge Lazar got it exactly right. I think her opinion should be this court's opinion. If your honors have no other questions, I'll yield my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Am I allowed to? Yes. Thank you, Your Honors. I just wanted to piggyback off Justice Karofsky's question about some of the case law, and I know Justice Bradley, you had talked about this as well. And I know you don't want me to cite to a jury instruction, so I'll get to the case. But in the self-defense jury instruction, footnote 3, they do talk about the phrase "in the defendant's position under the circumstances that existed at the time of the alleged offense," and that's developed from the Michelle versus Jonovic case, 69 West 2nd, 622, which is a 1975 decision by this court. And specifically what it says, Your Honors, is that that phrase, "in the defendant's position under the circumstances that existed at the time of the alleged offense," is intended to allow a consideration of a broad range of circumstances that relate to the defendant's situation. It's intended to create consideration of a broad range of circumstances. And I appreciate Justice Karofsky's point about Dr. Hanusa. You can't find a better expert, really, to testify about these important issues that exist. I know the issue of Marcy's Law was not specifically one that was certified by this court, but we do have the voters of this state passing Marcy's Law, enshrining in our Constitution victims' rights to put them on equal footing with criminal defendants.
So this is an interesting intersection between the sufficiency component. I mean, even if everything you're saying is true and we would agree with, the fact of the matter is that in this situation, based also on testimony of Dr. Stetzer, which I have on page 12, it's in the paragraph 24 of the Court of Appeals decision that she testified, "I thought, should I stop? And I thought, no, I'm not going to stop. I have called the police on two other occasions when being physically abused. Bill lied, and I got arrested."
Yes.
So you propainted it as if she'd be returned to the house. She's testifying, "I'm going to be arrested." We are talking about imminent death or great bodily harm. So maybe there is a situation where the person, even if seeing the police, could continue with the coercion defense. But in this case, we have a fact finder that this time was a judge that, based on the actual testimony and the facts here, made a decision. And so do we upend that decision? Do we say you couldn't possibly, it's not reasonable for you to have made that? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm asking a very long question.
Yes.
But this is where I'm stuck. So if you can help me with that.
Right. What he did say, though, is that the law doesn't ask me to consider whether Dr. Stetzer's actions were reasonable, and that's wrong. The law does require him to consider that. He is to look at the circumstances that existed in that moment for Dr. Stetzer.
Right, but she testified to what her circumstances were. She
right, so did
say
her.
"I was afraid of being returned home."
So did Bill, Your Honor. So her husband testified, too, that he was in a rage that night and had committed these violent acts against her. She testified about her fear that the criminal justice system, as the state said it, she didn't put it in these words, weaponization, but she talked about how, and testified about how historically when she's tried to report her husband's abuse to law enforcement, she's the one that ends up essentially being prosecuted. And so the question becomes, what would a reasonable person under those circumstances? Judge Bugenhagen did not look at this properly because he didn't look at it from the circumstances of a reasonable person. He said the law doesn't require him to consider that. And that's not true.
Counsel, there's another reading of what the trial court found here that seems to be, and this I think is how the Court of Appeals read it, which is that he was just saying, listen, I'm not saying it was just what a reasonable person might do generally, but then pivoted pretty quickly to looking at the kind of, this was, you know, reasonably believing this is the only way she could prevent, you know, bodily harm in applying that standard. So I wonder if there's a reading of it. The Court of Appeals looks at it and says, hey, you're making too much out of that statement. Maybe it was somewhat inartful given the statute. How would you respond to that?
I would respond by saying if you read Judge Bugenhagen's oral ruling, four separate times he uses that phrase, only means necessary. He was fixated on that language. But that language, only means necessary, only applies to the decision to commit the act, which the state has conceded she was privileged to do. And so I think the judge got it wrong because he was focused on that language and he discounted the whole reasonable belief language. With that, if there's no more questions, thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
Hey, thank you very much. Interesting oral argument. The court is adjourned. For the students that wish to have some time with Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, she will be out shortly. Thank you. Very interesting oral arguments today.